Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF, going strong for, God, I don't even know how many years. How many years has it been? Oh, my God. Like, since 2009, it's crazy. The guy at the post office, my guy Victor at the post office, said to me today, I went over there, and it turns out that a lot of the incoming has trickled off, which is probably for the best. I mean, there was so much stuff coming in there for a while. But down at the P.O. box, I see Victor. I've been seeing him for a long time. But he said to me today, he's known me for 20 years. The post office guy. I know this is not a big shocker in that plenty of people have people in their lives, especially if you live in the same city for a long time that you've known a long time. But there was just some moment there where I was like, oh, my God. And I look at him now. I look at me now. I remember when he was a younger guy, but he was always at the post office. He used to come see shows when I do the Steve Allen Theater, him and his girlfriend. They were kind of artsy people. And it's just, I don't know, man. I'm not in a zone where I'm like, where did the time go? But I am in a zone of like, holy shit, the time is gone. It's not where did it go. I know where it went. If I sit there and I put it into a chronological order, and I think of all the things I've been through, I can see that there's plenty of years between all of them. But when somebody says, you know, especially a guy at the post office, Victor says, I've known you 20 years, I'm like, holy shit. And I've been noticing that a lot lately. I'm not complaining, but I guess it happens. You hit a certain age, and there you are. You've known the guy at the post office for 20 years. But man, I don't know. It was kind of shocking because I had to stand there and be like, holy shit, it has been that long since I lived up in the old house and stuff, but it's all right. Not complaining. And for those of you who are wondering, I've been laying off it in terms of talking about it, but the foot is healing fine. No surgery necessary. Went to the doc yesterday. He said, you don't have to come back here anymore unless you're in pain or something happens. But get out there and live your life, he said. Enjoy it. Get on that foot. Work it. So that's where I'm at. No surgery. Little bit of pain in certain positions. Thank you for asking. Today on the show, Alex Edelman is here. He's a comic and writer. And I met him when he was a kid, and he rubbed me the wrong way, to be quite honest with you. And I don't know that that's unusual for this particular personality. And I think he understands that, but you know, you get older. I don't know. Yeah. He was just one of these kids. He was coming on strong. He started doing comedy when he was in his teens, and I met him. I can't even remember. It was the Comedy Cellar. He was down from New York. He's a Boston guy, and he was telling stories like he was an old guy. And, you know, we all do a little of that when you're trying to kind of wedge your way into the big guy's table, telling the tall tales about the road. But this kid was like 12. He wasn't 12. He was probably, I don't know, maybe 20, maybe 19. But there's always that moment where you realize later that maybe the reason why this guy rubbed me the wrong way is because he's a little like me. But, you know, he's doing the work. All right, he's doing the work, and it was one of these situations where I'm like, dude, this kid just did a special about being Jewish in a very Jewish way, and I think that's important. The voice of Jews as Jews, being Jewish, is necessary. No hiding, folks. No hiding. In 2022, his show Just For Us, which is the show, opened off-Broadway. Then it moved to Broadway the following year. It's now an HBO special. But ultimately, to have a conversation about the type of Judaism that he comes from, which is Orthodox, not Hasidic, Not ultra-Orthodox, but Orthodox, like, you know, wearing a kippah outside kind of deal, was something that, it was good. It was good for me. It was a good conversation to have. He's a thoughtful guy, a smart guy. The show is funny. And I think through this process, and I've done it with many people on this show, and I don't think I need to mention them by name, but, you know, I overcome whatever my my little peeves are, whatever my little resentment is, whatever, you know, my judgment is. I'm not saying that it fully goes away, but I thought that the conversation needed to happen, and I'm glad it did. I'm in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Sophie Buttle, the very funny Sophie Buttle, will be opening for me. Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd at the Wellmont Center. Glenside, Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area on Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick Theater. Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. Munhall, Pennsylvania outside Pittsburgh on May 9th at the Carnegie Library Music Hall. Cleveland, Ohio on May 10th at the Playhouse Square. Detroit, Michigan on May 11th at the Royal Oak Music Theater. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my dates and links to tickets. Some of those future dates may be compromised because I may be doing a big thing. I'll let you know when we announce it and when it's all set in stone. I might be doing a big thing, people. You know, I hammer away here at this show. I hammer away at my stand-up. I hammer away at my life. I do a lot of jobs. I wear a lot of hats. There's some hats that I wear less, and sometimes an opportunity comes along where they just want you to wear that hat, and then you got to suit up. Yeah, I mean, I'll let you know. I'll let you know. Don't freak out. Nothing provokes email like an ink spot on a shirt. I tell you, man, you know, people always send in emails, but the ink spot, that got a lot of feedback. And I got to be honest with you, everything you suggested to get the ink spot out of my shirt did not work. I didn't try the hairspray, but I tried the isopropyl alcohol. I tried the spot stuff, but maybe I think it might be too late for the hairspray, but thanks for all the input. But the most important input as of late, after my rambling about cortisol and hypervigilance and my own trauma and you know how my body has reacted to that, somebody sent me a thoughtful email about his experience with that stuff, with hypervigilance, cortisol, and exhaustion. And you know, and he brought up something interesting that I kind of thought of, but not so clearly. You know, when you have trauma in your life, there's something that you're wired to seek it out. You're wired to seek out what you grew up with. You're wired, that's where your emotional heart is in whatever chaos you grew up with, whatever, you know, boundary broken, selfish, abusive, whatever you grew up with, you will unconsciously seek because that's where you feel comfortable. You know, chaos, selfishness, embarrassment for me. And I always knew this, and it's hard to work against that wiring. All you can do is try. But this guy brought it up to me in this email. He said that perhaps, you know, well, he suggested conclusively that the reason I do comedy is to recreate some of that vibe that I grew up with. And I always knew, like, I've done jokes on stage where I do a joke that works and then one that is uncomfortable. And I used to say, that's what I do, folks. I bring you in and I push you away. I bring you in and push you away. It's a little dynamic I call dad. So I was hip to it, but I never was hip to the other component, which is, you know, the high wire of being on stage. What you're risking up there is not just acceptance, where you're asking these people to accept you, but it's also the potential for embarrassment is profound. And the potential for failure that leads to that embarrassment is profound. And the possibility of standing in embarrassment for God knows how long is real. It's a real possibility. And when I was growing up, this was the missing piece. My dad was erratic and a little bipolar and, you know, pretty self-involved. And you never knew where he was going to come from emotionally, whether he was going to yell or not. Not real capable of being grounded or being an example for anything other than insanity or aggravation and anger. But my mother, on the other hand, who was also very self-involved and completely insulated in her eating disorder, was also very embarrassing. Like, she would say embarrassing things. She would do embarrassing things when we were out. She always made me uncomfortable one way or the other on all levels. And then, like, that was the missing piece. I realized, holy fuck, maybe that is what I'm doing up there. And that maybe that's why I always say that. I don't know that I set out to be an entertainer. I set out to find a certain amount of personal truth and find my own space in the world and be seen and do it through funny. But this, for some reason, this piece just fit, and I'm quitting comedy. Kidding. I'm going to keep doing it, but only with a new sensibility. Something happened in the Midwest last week where I was like, you know what? If this is the only place I'm capable of being my whole self, and somehow or another I have transcended my parental systems in terms of what was negative about them through years and years of being on stage, then ultimately the end of that equation is I've become my whole self. It just happens to mostly just be on stage. But for fuck's sake, I'm 60. I might as well fucking enjoy it. Oh my God. There was some sort of revelation out there in the Midwest in terms of freedom of mind, comfort, being grounded on stage. I mean, I haven't been afraid to be up there in a long time, but it just was almost like I said to the audience, one of them, I said, you know, it's kind of tragic that the most intimate relationship I have is with you. A room full of 800 strangers in Minneapolis. It's a bizarre thing. I can't quite explain it, but I do think that that guy's assessment is probably true. And now I got to spread it out. Now I've got to get past the obstacles and fear and horrendous, my horrendous emotional stagnation that happened out of fear and try to come into myself in my personal life. There you go. A challenge. Something to work towards. I'm only 60. Maybe I'll get it before I die. I had given up on it, but maybe I can get it. Maybe I can fucking humble myself and figure out how to move through life with an open heart with people that I know, as opposed to people that come in and out of my garage or people I meet in passing or audiences. Root for me, people, would you? I can do it. I can do it. So look, this conversation with Alex, I was charmed. He's a bright guy and he's a funny guy. His show, Just For Us, was recorded for HBO during its Broadway run and now streaming on Max. This is me and the young Alex Edelman.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
I mean, what was I going to do? I couldn't interview without going to the show.
They would have sent you a link. You could have just
to the special. HBO thing. No, Alex, I went to your show. I went to your show because that's part of my job.
I'm sorry.
But it's
I'm
all right.
Glad you came.
So, no, like I don't know that I entered with necessarily the right attitude.
Okay, what's the attitude you came in with? I had a concern all the way through.
While you were on stage?
Well, I had a bit of a headache problem last night, but besides that,
yeah.
I was concerned. I thought, maybe in a nice way, but also I thought, I wonder if Mark can see his, like, fingerprints on this.
Oh, really?
I wondered if you could see the sort of, like, the influence of yourself.
Where do you
on
see it?
You know, look, people love to compare Jewish comedians to each other.
Yeah.
And in terms of thinking about what it means to be Jewish,
yeah,
in terms of your interior life, is pretty different than sort of being like, Ashkenazis are like this, and do this, sure, that, and they. And so, like, there aren't a ton of Jewish comedians who actually do that.
It's funny though. It's not, you know, even saying Ashkenazi is too specific.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? It's just Jews are like this.
Jews are like this. Yeah, they all talk like this, and they do. And that's so, right. Like, you never. I mean, you allude to stuff like that. Like when you're in the last special, you talked about like the Israeli music playing and stuff before the thing. But it's like, I don't know that there are a ton of comedians. Can you think of like five Jewish comedians who are like, I'm not challenging you to literally come up with the names, but if you think about any comedians who talk about what their Judaism means to them on stage, like, I don't know there are a ton that do that.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, and for me, it's an evolving thing, you know, especially in the climate we're living in lately on stage, because I continue adding to the conversation about, you know, my Jewishness and what Jewishness is. Mm-hmm. And I'm not as Jewy as you. In any way.
You wrote a book called Jerusalem Syndrome.
Yeah, but that was
got good cred.
Yeah, but that was not, you know, that was not exploring the religion. It's still it's still exploring the identity, right? So I think, you know, in terms of comics talking about it, I don't think there's that many Jewish comics, period, anymore.
I think that's probably true. And I think, but when you say exploring the religion, the identity as opposed to the religion, my identity is much more tied to the religion, I think, in background than yours was.
Right.
But I'm still doing the thing of talking about my Jewish identity in a way that, well, you know, you've done for a bunch of specials.
Sure. Well, no, I didn't see my fingerprints on anything. But like, I used to do this bit about, I did it that day when we did the event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever that was. What was that for?
Variety.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The thing about that, I think that antidepressants killed Jewish comedy in the 80s. Like, they all got better, you know.
That's a good fucking joke.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, I grew up with a certain, with my identity was sort of tied to that, you know, and my Jewishness was, you know, conservative Jew, you know, did the thing, you know, did the bar mitzvah. But the thing that I liked about your show, and I didn't want to like your show because, you know, like, I don't have a problem with you, but maybe there's, you know, some sort of, you know, maybe I see myself in you, or I think that you're annoying in a way. But, you know, you covered that. You seem to be able to sort of be aware of what you assume other people are thinking, whether you're annoying or neurotic or whatever.
Look, I'm not the most, I came from an Orthodox Jewish background, and then I decided to become a comedian for all everyone saying that comedy is Jewish. It's not as if I was raised in the most socially adroit environment. It took me a little while to pick up tact and pick up and not just always be in everyone's face all the time. And
there was a couple
so
of guys that were Orthodox that didn't work on Saturdays. You know, Mark Schiff.
Elon Gold.
Well, he was later. There was another guy. What was that guy? Morris. Mark. Morris. What was his first name? He was another guy, like, when I was coming up that was older than me. Mark Schiff was, like, Seinfeld's generation.
I'm reading his book now, actually. He came and gave me his book. And it's,
did he?
Yeah, he doesn't work on Shabbos, but yeah, I was annoying. I was, like, and I still am a little annoying. I'm fucking annoying. Like, I'm just, like, I'm always there. I'm just, like, my breath is too loud. I'm just, like,
wanting connection.
I mean, yeah, like I've always, but also I always wanted to be a comedian.
Yeah.
And I was always a huge comedy fan.
Yeah.
And so there aren't a ton of ways to learn from a distance. But yeah, I was just too in everyone's lap a little bit when I started.
Not anymore? Do you have your own lap now?
I'm a little the only sad part of the show for me.
Yeah.
Is that it does kind of take you far away from everyone else. Like I haven't. For the last, you know, 5-6 years, a lot of the shows that I've done have been away from the comedy community. I do them in theaters, like
Jewish
Steppenwolf.
Community?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do them in JCCs and on cruise ships that are kosher. No, I do it, but like, not really. But
you haven't done any JCCs?
No JCCs. They're mostly theaters with the population of a JCC coming to a place that might as well be the Meyerson Upper West Side JCC.
Sure.
But I don't really, I don't see comedians as much as I used to. It's kind of a shame. So but you know, also not the worst thing in the world, like you said. Like I have my own lap right now, but like, yeah, I'm a little annoying, and also I'm a comedy fan, so like that thing where you can just like pretend to, where you can just like be chill,
yeah,
like it's taken me Like, when I am chill, I am faking it. Because I'm always like, because the real me is like freaking out that I get to be in like same comedy club as like Dave Attell.
Yeah.
Or, you know, when I play The Cellar every night, I'm like, gee, it's like I'm fucking Make-A-Wish. Like, I can't believe that I work out at the.
Well, let's go back then. So.
Sure.
Is Dave Rath your manager?
No, I haven't worked with Dave for like a year, but he was my first.
He got you all the stuff, the breaks.
No, I mean, he's a lovely man, but yeah, look, a lot of my stuff came from abroad. So my manager in the UK, Chris Lander.
What's his company?
He was with a company called Phil McIntyre. Then he was independent for a little while, and then he's not really in the business anymore. But Edinburgh was sort of where I made my bones, I guess.
Yeah, all right, but not as a comic, as a one-person show guy.
I mean, to me, they're interchangeable. Yeah. To me, they're really, like, you do comedy.
Done both. I've done one-person shows. Jerusalem Syndrome was a one-person show.
But not to push back on this, Mark, but didn't you incubate a lot of the bits that go in your one-person shows and stand-up comedy rooms?
No, I know. I can see what you were doing. I mean, I understand the format.
Yeah.
And then I understand that, you know, you want a through line. And I think I do that with my specials now in the form of some callbacks and some themes. Mm-hmm. I agree that there's not a huge difference, but you are given the option to, you know, with a one-person show to work in front of a crowd that's expecting that, and to infuse some silences,
yeah,
with some moments of
some
sort of
tension,
yeah, you know. So I mean, that's what it affords you, and on some level, as a comic, you know, what you're afforded through a one person show is the
full attention,
not necessary to be funny all the time.
Yeah, but think it should. But it should be, though.
No.
Right? Like, you know, look, your last special had some tension, and, you know, and some.
I'm not taking shots at the format.
No, I don't think you are. I'm just saying that I always thought that those two. I'm not being disingenuous when I say I think the two are the same. I think stand-up can have silences and not need to be funny all the time, and is really
sure.
Like, I truly believe that the two things are extremely closely knit and really work when you cross them over.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and I think, though, that it gives you an opportunity to explore something more thoroughly.
Oh, 1,000%. And by the way, having good, like, Dave Rath was really instrumental in terms of, like, pointing me towards places that I didn't know about that did have comedy spaces that did have, like, Uncabaret.
Sure.
Like, Dave would point, like, Uncabaret is a good example of a place where, like, you can do comedy that has a little more thoughtfulness without it being sort of one-man show. I like the blurry boundary place.
Sure. So you just went with other management ultimately?
I don't have another manager.
No? Have an agent?
I just have an agent.
Yeah. I just know Math my whole life.
For a decade, he's the only manager I ever worked with.
Yeah, yeah. But your intention after a certain point was not club comedy, really.
I mean, I still love club comedy. I also think my solo shows come out of club comedy. Like,
the jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I could see the bits that were bits, and I could see how you could really, I mostly work all of that shit out in a club, really.
Yeah, they were all, even the story at the center was, you know, like a 20-minute bit at the end of a club show for a while.
I figured that. It seemed like it was, because you had to sort of pare that down, figure out the beats.
I love club. I think I'm always going to be, hopefully always get to be a club comedian. I'm going back on the road in a couple of weeks.
Just a headline outside?
Just a headline, like Bloomington. I'll do the Comedy Attic. I'll do the comedy thing in Providence. I'm doing an hour at Netflix as a joke festival. It's just going to be comedy. Like, you know, yeah. I love being a club comic too. It's all I ever wanted to be, you know.
So where'd you grow up in the Boston area?
Brookline.
Like, up from, like, I used to live in Brookline.
Yeah. Like, I live up on, you know, the reservoir on Route 9?
Yeah.
So, like, right near the Jewish day school that I went to. But, like, yeah, near Cleveland Circle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I worked in Coolidge Corner. And I was
all my childhood. Yeah. Near the movie theater?
Sure. Yeah, I worked at a place called Edibles that was owned by a couple of Jewish hippies.
You're kidding.
No. And then I worked at Matt Garrett's for as a waiter.
Oh my God.
My girlfriend worked in college, worked at the Coolidge Corner Theater.
That's where I saw my movies growing up, and you're across the street from Brookline Booksmith, which is where
the Booksmith.
Yep. Still there. It's great.
And then there's that weird kosher deli down the street, Rubens.
Rubens is closed now, which is horrible, but it was the only kosher game in town for a while.
I bet you don't remember this because you're too young, but I used to work at like one of the last sort of culturally Jewish delis in the Boston area, which was Gordon's.
My grandfather would talk about Gordon's. It would come up. My grandfather would be like, you don't know, but Rubens can't hold a candle to Gordon's.
It's
like,
true, because Gordon's was not kosher.
Yeah.
It was just, it was Jewish.
But people would come in, kosher Jews would come in and sort of wistfully buy products that were kosher in, like pickles and stuff
sure,
like that.
Sure, pickles and all the breads. There's a thing about, like I had to learn, because I did that, I was in college, and it was crazy, dude.
Because you went to BU.
Yeah. It was at Puttingham Circle in West Roxbury.
Yeah, of course.
Next to the Chinese restaurant.
I know exactly. There's a firehouse nearby where we would burn our bread before Passover.
Really?
Yeah, like our chametz. Like you're not allowed to have bread on Passover.
So they'd make that service available to you?
Yeah, you go to the parking lot of the firehouse in West Randolph and you'd burn your bread in a barrel next to the firehouse while the firefighters watch these Jews.
Is that true?
With crossed arms, just watch us throw bread into a fiery barrel. It was insane.
And many Jews were there in the parking lot?
Dozens. Dozens of Jews trying hard not to get smoke in their face, using the yarmulkes to wave the smoke away.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the guys who used to come into to Gordon's, your grandfather was probably one of them. I learned some weird lessons about Jews, because I had a very idealized idea of what Jews were. And then all these Jews who were probably your grandfather's age, some of them were, cops. Some of them were plumbers. There was a mailman, and I was sort of like, Jews do these jobs?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But for some reason, there was a contractor, like a mob contractor that used to come in, a guy that did the business.
That makes sense. There was a guy that my parents told me about, a guy named Doc Sagansky, who was a Jewish mobster who was a little old Jewish man who was almost a billionaire from running numbers or something. He was an insane philanthropist who just lived in a one bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
And lived a Jewy life. And there were Jewish mobsters in Boston.
Well, of course they started the mob. I mean, the mob is half Jewish.
Of course.
But these guys would come in, right from the fucking hospital, with IV band-aids on, after they got their blood work done and eat a corned beef sandwich.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. And there's stuff in Boston that you can't get anywhere else, like grape nut pudding.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Holy shit. This is, by the way, this is my grandparents' language, grape nut pudding.
Yeah.
The Boston thing that I love are the old-fashioned ice cream parlors.
Yep.
Those things are kind of gone.
Yep.
But, there were these places, like White Mountain Creamery, or even the Friendlies that looked
like Friendlies. The original Steve's?
Yes.
In Somerville?
I thought it was in Newton, but I remember all of those hyper-local places, man. Boston was so blessed.
Emacabolio's?
Yeah, well, Emacabolio's became a chain.
I know, but it wasn't.
A really shitty little place on right off the sea line. And you'd go.
On
Beacon Street, right? Yeah. Sea line on Beacon Street. Yep. And you would go in, and now you see them everywhere, and it's kind of a shame.
Are they everywhere?
They're at least a chain.
I think they kind of crapped out. But the original Steve's was kind of a thing in Somerville because he invented the mix-in.
No way.
Yes. That was the thing. He was the first guy to put it on the slab, pound in the shit, put it in the fucking bowl.
Cold Mountain Creamery took Steve's idea.
Totally. Yes, and then Steve's became Harrell's.
Oh, my God. Dude, Harrell's is the greatest.
But that's Steve Harrell. That's from the original Steve's in Somerville, and then he sold out.
So Harrell's is in Newton. So there's the Steve's. It's right near the highway. It's right on that.
Right. Well, exactly. Steve's went away, and then it became Harrell's because I think that's how we franchised it. But all this aside, the Jewish thing in Boston was different to me because I grew up identifying with the New York thing, and it's different. There's four fucking kinds of rye bread in Boston.
Yeah, of course.
Sisal rye, light rye, pumpernickel, and dark. Four. And then guys would come in, order the heel of the bread. What the fuck is that? Do you
My
even know what that is?
I liked the heel of the bread.
Right.
We hated it. I hated it, but he would eat the heel of the bread. By the way, we would save the bags, or we'd not save the bags, but you'd have five bags with the little nubs at the end. Yeah. My grandfather would eat them
Well, they'd have you cut it. Like if someone ordered the heel with cream cheese or something, you had to cut it off so it's like 3 inches and slice it the other way.
That's right.
I remember the first time someone ordered, I just pulled a bunch of little pieces out of a bag, threw it on a plate. Like, and they're like, no, this is not. Yeah. Jesus oh, it was something, Christ. Man. It was something. That was
a good place to start comedy, Boston, by the way.
Well, I mean, but tell me about like, well, I know I started there, you know, I think legitimately. It was hard to start there, but it was different, you know, to be, for me, you know, because you're kind of a, you know, overly, I don't want to say obsequious, but, you know, a very charming performer. What?
Pandering and solicitous, I prefer.
Yeah, those are better. Special, yeah. But I was just this fucking young, you know, angry, sweaty Jewish guy who was half high all the time running around to one-nighters in the New England area.
That's the only way to do it. You would go to the mic at the Burren. You would go to the mic at the Connection. You go to the various Dick Doherty.
Yeah, but I would drive out. There was a whole one-nighter network where I learned how to do time. You know, you'd go to Pancho Villa's in Leominster. And you go to the Taunton Regency to do their weekend show.
Tony V and Frank Santarelli and Steve Sweeney and all these, and Lenny Clark and Don Gavin, they all would take me, you know, I was in high school. I was a senior in high school.
And you do open for them?
Yeah, I was terrible. And they would still, they'd drive me out to Randolph.
Take the hit.
And yeah, they give me, Steve Sweeney gave me $100, $100 bill. And I remember I could not believe I was getting that much money for a show in like somewhere on the Cape.
Yeah.
Like, it was awesome. And you drive out with these guys and they'd have great stories. They were always really nice to me.
Oh, that's good.
Not everyone's act was fantastic.
It was what it was.
It was fantastic.
Yeah,
was
but great. That's, yeah, the car rides were always, did you have to drive?
Sometimes, but my heart was in my throat because I just got my permit and I was like, I was like, fuck, I really hope I don't get pulled over.
But I think the most interesting thing to me about the show, I thought that the conceit of the white supremacist meeting was more in the show, you know, it was just someplace where you landed, you know, to sort of set up other things, which were obviously, you know, structured bits. But I you know, I thought it was going to be like the whole show, but it's really just a place to come back to.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the show is a long, like so many solo shows, like just a long explanation of me.
Yeah.
Requires a lot of explanation.
But now, so it's just you and your brother?
Two brothers. One's not really in the show. Not really in the show.
Why is that?
It didn't shake out that way. There was not a ton of room for him.
Are you the youngest?
I'm the oldest.
And there's the
Olympians, 2 years younger than me. AJ is an Israeli Olympian. And then Austin is 8 years younger than me.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he's still a kid now, almost.
He's 26 years old.
I think I met him. Who did I meet?
Yeah, you met Austin. You met Austin. He's a nice kid.
Yeah, but it didn't have as good a backstory as the Olympiad for the show.
No, he's not in this one. There's only one bit about my brother.
Yeah.
Or two bits actually, but Austin wasn't born yet when we had the Christmas bit.
So yeah,
story about having Christmas. And,
but walk me through this because I what I thought was most interesting was the specifics about Jewish education, about a religious education, and in terms of how it informs one's Jewish identity. Mm-hmm. Like, because I can only speak to, you know, in generalizations. You know, I used to do a bit about the difference between a Jew's relationship with their God and a Christian's relationship with their God, and that, you know, the Jews are arguing. You know, they're like, what? You want me to do that? You know, like, and then the Christians are just like, I'm sorry. So...
I have a bit about the Jewish relationship, that their relationship is Jesus take the wheel. Like this woman lets her hands go in the song and Jesus takes the wheel. And I go, and Jesus does take the wheel and he drives her and that baby to safety. And that is not how it works for the Jews.
That's right. Yeah, it was more contentious. It was unpredictable. Oh, it's all right.
But Jewish education thing. Sorry.
But so you're Orthodox.
Yeah, I was raised Orthodox. I still consider myself like modern Orthodox, even though I'm not as like Shabbos observant as Mark Schiff or kosher observant.
Well, what does that mean, modern Orthodox? You don't wear a kippah usually. Sometimes you do.
No, yeah, sometimes I wear a kippah.
Where would you decide to wear a kippah?
I like to wear it in my home life and with my and with my friends sometimes. I don't like wearing it in non-kosher restaurants. I like wearing it in environments where it's not the first thing people will see and be like, oh.
Do you have to wear it at home?
I don't have to, but I wear it sometimes. When I'm at home in Boston, I do try to wear it. Yeah, like
your dad
honestly,
always wears it?
Always. When you met him, he wore it.
Yeah.
He is, frankly, if I'm being completely honest, I kind of wish I had never stopped wearing it, but I think it would.
Why? What's the conflict there? I mean, why? If you're completely honest, what is it that you think you're doing by not wearing it?
You know, I just didn't want to. When I was a kid, I didn't want anything else to alienate me from people, given that I was already such an alienating, already felt so alienated from everyone I met.
Who wasn't Jewish?
Even Jews, you know, I was raised in very specific Judaism. Like you said, Boston Judaism is very unusual. Yeah, Boston, but Orthodox, modern Orthodox, real distinction. It's like no one I grew up with wore like black suits with white shirts and hats.
Isn't that ultra-Orthodox?
Yeah, but there is a little more. There are like literally 10 to 15 gradations of Orthodox. In Muncie, Lawrence, out on Long Island, there are so many different kinds of Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
And so what I mean when I say is I wish I'd never stopped wearing the yarmulke is like, you know, if I start wearing it now, it'd be some sort of like statement of reclamation.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel like there's, you know, a thing to reclaim. It's just like I feel pretty comfortable in my everyday life, you know, as a Jewish person, but like I've always been slightly resistant of the label of like Jewy comedian in a way that I'm like not totally, because like you don't want to, like I'm a comedian that I truly think is accessible to anyone, but like I think that desire to be accessible to anyone has led to me pushing down certain parts of my Jewish personality, which is to me what the show is about. The show to me is a lot more about assimilation than it is about anti-Semitism.
No, absolutely. And I think the show is you reclaiming your Jewishness as a comic that you avoided doing in, you know, Taunton or on the Cape.
Sure. You're right.
And I dealt with the same thing. I didn't talk about being Jewish for years because I didn't want it to be a stereotype. And, you know, when your heroes are like, you know, Richard Lewis or Lenny Bruce or Buddy Hackett or Don Rickles, where it was just understood. I mean, that group of Jews who kind of built modern stand-up, they, outside of Lenny Bruce, were not... And Lenny Bruce was specifically Jewish.
Sure.
But a lot of the other ones weren't. They you just knew they were Jews, and they'd refer to it occasionally. But, like, he was still speaking in Yiddish sometimes.
But even, like, you know, I wonder sometimes, is my Jewish identity interesting to anyone who's not Jewish?
But now it's like, before, in the 70s, it was known. It was accepted. The comics are Jews.
Yeah.
And now that identity, it used to be a cultural identity that was prominent because most of it was coming out of New York and it was, and even in all the arts, it was just a culturally prominent. And now it's culturally prominent for bad reasons. And also it's not as
true.
Prominent.
You're right. You're 1,000% right. I've never heard anyone say it, but the comics, there aren't a ton of Jewish comedians anymore. The trope of
that identify.
It makes me a little bit sad. There are some
really
good
ones. What about
scared? What?
Does it make you scared?
I'm weirdly like an anti-Semitism minimalist.
Yeah.
In the sense that I never feel like, because I'm always so embarrassed when anyone's like, there's a swastika in the New York Times crossword puzzle. I'm like, there's not a swastika. Shut up.
What about
like,
a swastika on a grave?
Yeah, that's harder to deny. Yeah. It feels like there's more of that now.
Yes.
Like, it really feels like it's just more in my face. And I've always wanted to deny it. And it seems every day or every passing month, it seems much harder to deny. So, like, a little bit. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little bit scared in a way that I absolutely wasn't a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Right.
Like now, you know, the venues have like security for me. And like occasionally someone sends me an Instagram message that I'm like, should I forward this to someone? You know, like it's.
Have you?
No, but there was one time right after October 7th, I got a couple of comments on my Instagram page that and I just like shut off the comments. Not even that I'm like was wading into the Israel-Palestine stuff.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with listening to it and thinking about it, but I'm not really sure where I stand yet. So I've not said much, but some people left some comments where I was like, shit. You know, one guy was like, I'm going to come to San Francisco on October 28th and behead you in front of your Zionist buddies. And I was like, well, the shows end on the 27th. You know? Like, I'm not sticking around for the beheading. You know?
Unless we plan a lunch meet.
Yeah. You want to meet my cousins? They are Zionists. You know, it's okay.
Here's their address in Israel.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm handling it much in the same way you are in that, you know, I kind of play out the options of position.
Sure.
I say, here are the three positions. You know, I'm a Zionist, I'm a free Palestine Jew, or I just want it all to stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you do the I just want it all to stop, that's when people are like, what the fuck are you even talking about?
Yeah, of course.
So I leave it open like that. But then I did actually write a joke with, because I didn't want to speak to it as somebody, as an intellect, mm-hmm. or as a pundit. Mm-hmm. So I had to write a joke, you know, addressing it that does have a point of view. But this is interesting because I think about it a lot too, and I'm not even as Jewy as you. I mean, you are a guy that, you know, had a God in place.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was fully... I'm not sure I think I believe in God. I just have like notes. I'm just like annoyed. I've
sure,
got,
but,
like,
but that's what the entire Talmud is,
yeah.
right?
I mean, essentially, more than anything, I'm not sure I believe in God, but I definitely believe in the Torah. Like, not the literal thing, but I believe that like there's something good and interesting about the Jewish worldview that like carefully examines all sides of a discourse.
Yes.
Like that to me always really works for me. I like to hear everyone's like point of view and hold opinions strongly but loosely at the same time, and like I like trying to square impossible, you know, contradictory things with each other and see if they can coexist at the same time. Like that thing really works for me. Like that's a thing that I found that like
and you find that's directly relative to your Talmud schooling?
Sure. I mean, that's what the Talmud is. It gives you hear everyone's opinion. You can, sometimes they pick a side, but most often they go, everyone's opinion comes from a pretty honest place. And like, I think that there's some relevance to that in the world right now. You know, I think there's relevance to like carefully trying to take in everyone's like frustrations and pain and wants and, you know, the facts that people have chosen to put a lot of weight into from various sides and trying to figure out a thing that works for everyone. It's like, it can come out as a pretty random centrism, but like, it's kind of what works for me. Like, I mean, the show is sort of about empathy and the limits of empathy, and that's definitely from my
conditional
Judaism.
Conditional empathy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, I think that was interesting where you had to deal with, you know, what is your Jewishness and what is just you as a needy person? that the instinct to empathy can be a couple of things, you know, in terms of a guy with a personality like yours or the one I used to have when I'm not, you know, tamping it down, is that I think your need to be liked will force you into an adjustment with almost anybody.
Sure, but do you think that sometimes that need to be liked and that need to not be invisible are at odds with each other? Right? Like, I know that sometimes the thing to do to be liked is to completely disappear in a room. And my need to...
But disappear how? Like, you know, wall? You know, you don't talk?
Yeah,
you
like go become into furniture, essentially, and just, like, listen and, you know...
Yeah, I rarely had that thing.
Really, I think in a room, especially with younger people in urban environments, strong personalities, taking up less space is literally the thing to do. But my desire to be liked and my desire to also be a presence, those things sometimes are at odds with each other. And so that's
But are they? Because it seems that, you know, if you have a innate desire to connect... in an almost, you know, codependent way, that you're sacrificing part of yourself like that. You're diminishing, you're becoming invisible in a different way because you're just volunteering to be an extension of whatever.
Sure,
you're
becoming a chameleon, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm saying that the desire to become a chameleon it can be not just dehumanizing, but it can be event. Like if you walk into a room and go, all right, if I'm going to give everybody $20 and then they'll like me, you know, like you can give everyone $20, but it's still not enough to feel like seen, I guess.
No, you're just a guy that gave him $20.
Yeah,
and half of those people are like, what the fuck's with this idiot?
A thousand percent. But I'm saying like the way to, sometimes that is what's necessary, but in order to actually like, I feel that, I don't want to just be liked. I want to be seen.
Yeah, I'm right? Exactly the same way. I mean, I think that's why I started doing comedy, was to find my own territory.
I love that because I think that's the thing. One of the things that I admired about comedians is that is that you get to go up there and explain yourself.
Yeah,
and people enjoy it and they laugh at it and come away with a greater understanding of a person and maybe people writ large. Like that seems like a really fun job. I think the thing that made me
I used to think it was a noble job.
I think it's still a noble job.
Like you know that this is my point of view. You know, this is and the only context, you know, was that you had to be funny. That was the only rule. But outside of that, you do whatever the fuck you want.
But don't you think that the thing that made me want to be
I feel
a
like
comedian,
I interrupted. Yeah, go ahead.
No. But Mark, that's the same. But like, it's very the same thing. Like the thing that made me want to be a comedian was that
right
that you can express yourself in a certain way, and also everyone hanging out. I saw the Aristocrats at the Coolidge Corner Theater.
Yeah.
Whenever it was in theaters, must have been.
I got to tell you, I had never knew anything about that joke ever in my life before that movie.
Me neither. Right. Obviously, I was a child.
But I was old.
But like, more than anything else, that joke is fine, but the community of people, the premise of the movie is comedians sit around with each other and they tell each other this joke. What a great joke. And I was like, wait, comedians sit around with each other?
Sure.
Like, that's the thing that I wanted. I wanted to sit at tables with funny people and be in that sort of...
Yeah, it's a special club of awkward people and social rejects and borderline criminals.
I always love... I mean, look, everything you want in a table. That's really interesting.
Yeah. But eventually, you know, you sit at the table long enough and you get to the point where you're like, oh, here we go.
Yeah, I think that's true, though. I think it's sad.
You come out the other side, you get older, and then you find yourself doing it again. But tell me about... Yeshiva education. So you're because like now, and also I was talking to somebody yesterday about you know, I still think that kind of middle class conservative Jewry is the dominant, right? At least in this country, that the number of Orthodox or ultra Orthodox is still
10% less.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I think it's like small. Yeah.
Because I still think for most Jews, when they see a Jew wearing a kippah, they're like, "Oh, there's a good one, I guess." You know. So what do we? there's a dual kind of reaction.
Well, here's my question: How big? Sorry, you're going somewhere, and I'm
right. Well, that where I was going was that you know, the kippah and the traditions are you know the constant reminder of your relationship with God and Jewishness, right? So, you know, and if you do those things, you know, you are a practicing Jew. But it seems to me that the Jewish education, and this is what came through in the show, was that there were principles and ethics and ideas that kind of defined your humanity, right? I mean, you speak of it, that, you know, the idea of putting a premium not only on education, which you didn't really cover, but empathy, you know, I don't know if I ever framed that as a Jewish thing, per se.
No, but I think that Jewish laws aim for the intersection of empathy and fairness, right? Like ethics, empathy and accountability.
Ethics and humility and humanity.
But you're right. There's a human value as opposed to a Jewish one. That's why.
No, but they're not necessarily taught. You were taught them.
I was taught that your actions were informed by a spiritual backbone, that you had to act in the way that you possibly in the best way that you possibly could. But it's a very I don't know if it's specifically my Jewish education, but yeah, I think it was. I think the radical empathy part is the is the sort of Jewish bit, which
right? But even that in the show comes up against, exclusionary ideas. The idea that you know the reason why your mother did Christmas one year, you know, was in service of somebody in pain who was not Jewish, who was a friend, and she thought it would be the right thing to do,
yeah,
because of that woman's situation. Yet the rabbi, when it got back to him, you know, reframed it in a biblical way and saw no lenience.
Well, it's not that he saw no lenience. I tried to make his perspective worthwhile also, but I think his perspective was, you've confused your kids. You've introduced Christmas, and now are you going to take it away from them next year? Are you going to take Christmas away? Or are you going to let them keep celebrating it? And also, you know, by the way, sometimes Jews come to the show. It's rare.
Yeah.
But it happens. Jews come to the show and they tell me, you know, your father was right and your mother was wrong. Like, you don't have Christmas in a Jewish home.
Period.
Like, well, you know, Jews used to get killed on Christian holidays. Easter was a bad one.
Yeah.
Halloween was a bad one. You know, and Christmas was particularly not a good holiday for Jews because Jews were oftentimes accused of killing Jesus. So there is a history of pain in Orthodox Jewish communities or for any community where Judaism is the animating force, where some people have a real animus towards Christmas and they really are frustrated by the funny thing is, I think that environment of loving of doing Christmas for a family is actually weirdly an American one.
Yeah.
Like, because, and maybe it's slightly idealized, but my grandfather, the one who reminded me of Gordon's grew up, who lived in Boston, my grandfather lived next door to this family called the Rockets, and they were Boston College, Irish Catholics, crosses on the walls, you know, everything. And on, you know, on holidays that, like, my grandfather would, like, you know, help Dr. Rocket put up his Christmas tree, and Dr. Rocket would help my grandfather put up his sukkah, you know, the hut the Jews sit in. I'm like, and there was a moment, I think, I don't know when it was, maybe 60s, 70s, 80s, where Americans who lived next door to each other with different faiths and backgrounds would, like, help each other out.
Sure.
If they could. And Boston is actually pretty diverse. And so, you know, there are black people on our block and Christian people on our block and Muslim people on our block.
In Boston, the black people are on your block?
In Brooklyn, yeah.
All right.
Well, the houses were like, it was a working class neighborhood.
Oh, okay. I've never been in a more segregated city in my life.
Boston?
Yeah.
I think downtown, I think it's gotten worse. I think it used to be.
Well, I mean, when I was there, it was like Mattapan was black, Roxbury was black, Dorchester and Southie were Irish, and then, you know, the bulk of the city was a bit confusing. You know, that it seemed very, you know, provincial and college-driven, but, you know, you definitely got the sense that the surrounding areas had very specific ethnic.
A lot of those places were changed, you know, a lot of those places, like, it used to be Beacon Hill, which is now the waspiest place, and it was a black neighborhood, started as a black neighborhood, Beacon Hill. And it was a neighborhood mostly for the descendants of escaped slaves. It was
is that true?
Oh, yeah. And there are still and Beacon Hill is rabbit warrened with alleys because it used to be if you people were allowed to go back to the north to try to track down their escaped slaves, and in some of these alleys they have bells up on the wall.
Yeah,
and people would run into the alley and they'd ring the bell if they were trying to run from someone.
Yeah.
And everyone would flood into the alley. And so, like, those, and there's a history, there's like an African American Beacon Hill History Museum there. It's at the end of one of these alleys, these gorgeous alleys. And now it's probably some of the most expensive real estate in the world. And it's exclusively where, like, the John Kerry types live. But it used to be a black neighborhood in Brookline. Like, North Brookline was a whole different thing. And, like, a couple of North Brookline kids who were African American, like, played college basketball at a high level.
Sure.
Like, Brookline High was a pretty segregated place. Or, sorry, it's pretty integrated place, yeah.
So when do you start to move away from Orthodox?
Weirdly, it's like, I hadn't even left high school. I got a job at the Red Sox. I got a job working for the baseball team.
Yeah.
I wrote, like, the kids' newsletter and shit like that.
Yeah.
And because I didn't want to be just like the Orthodox kids, stopped wearing the yarmulke as much around the ballpark and started, you know, going to work on Saturdays. And but I think it was college is where I sort of, like...
Where'd you go to school?
I went to NYU, but I still consider myself pretty, like... I still consider myself, like... Judaism's still a bit of an animating force. I like to have Shabbos when I can. I keep a modicum of kosher. I don't eat pork or shellfish. It's like, I've never considered myself as like a lapsed modern Orthodox guy, but I clearly am when you compare me to like Elon or Mark Schiff or one of those guys.
Well, you know, I mean, you address that in the show, that when Christians are sort of like, yeah, I'm out.
And then
Jews is like, you can't get out.
Yeah, you can't ever leave. It's the fucking Hotel California.
Yeah.
You can never go. But the other thing is, to some people, you're like the most Jewish person. I was thinking about it when I said the joke last night. Like, there are some people for whom Marc Maron is like the most Jewish thing you can possibly get to.
I guess only because I talk about it in a certain way. But you're much more Jewish than me. And even by the in the sense of this show, I mean, it's so clearly a Jewish show.
Yeah.
And you know, when I saw the audience, I'm like, well, this is interesting because you've obviously been, you've got the blessing Orthodox contingent because they're there, and then you've got, you know, regular kind of, you know, middle class conservatives and Reform Jews, though, that, you know, there's a spectrum of Jew that is going to take this in because it's either, you know, nostalgic or it's, but I think that there is a conversation you're trying to have with the show about Jews, and it's sort of the anti-Semitism part is really, it's not what the show's about, because, you know, at the end of it, there's no great victory.
No.
And ultimately, you know, there's no real threat either.
No. Very banal.
Right, which is interesting, because, like, on a day-to-day basis, as a guy who's, you know, not Orthodox, you know, I feel the threat of anti-Semitism in a profound way.
I mean, I feel it too. I feel there are different types of anti-Semitism. By the way, only like 40
different types. So there's Orthodox anti-Semitism.
No. There's
conservative anti-Semitism.
I mean, there's anti-Semitism that goes, we want to wipe out the Jews. And then there's anti-Semitism that goes, we want to wipe out Judaism. So you're allowed to be Jewish as long as it doesn't like actually mean anything.
Mm.
You're allowed to be Jewish like in name only, as long as you've got no affinity for Judaism, as long as like it's just not in our face.
Yeah.
Right? As long as like, you know, all the people who
quiet
are like,
down, Jew.
Exactly. As long as it's like the same, not the same, because I don't know but
America was like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all those the conversations of Jews in the 20s and 30s that we're just trying to pass.
1,000%. The funny thing is everyone goes, my grandfather changed our name at Ellis Island. That never happened. Like, you couldn't change your name at Ellis Island. It'd be like changing your name at LaGuardia. Like, it doesn't work that way. It was like, there were customs, but people had to apply to change their names. And everyone who, there's a good book about it called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name.
Yeah.
It was a fucking funny title. But like, everyone had to apply to change their name in New York City whenever they got here. And it was like a long, months-long process. And the number one reason for changing your name was anti-Semitism. And the number two reason for changing your name was non-Jews who had names that sounded too Jewish and they were experiencing anti-Semitism.
Really?
Yeah. So no one ever changed. So like, but you're right. Jews desperately wanted to pass. And I think there's a lot of shame around that, because whenever anyone's like, oh, my grandfather changed his name at Ellis Island, what you're saying is it wasn't their fault to change from Rosenberg to Rose. It was just like, you know, the...
Right, right. It happened. The guy made a decision.
Yeah, someone made a decision.
But that's not true.
No, it's not
true.
Myth. You had to exactly match the ship's manifest for national security reasons. Otherwise, they would send you back at the expense of the shipping company.
Yeah.
So no one ever... So everything was very much dotted and crossed when you got to Ellis Island.
Well, the opening theme of your show is wanting to pass, really.
I desperately did. Yeah, I really wanted to. I still kind of want to. It's like...
But you do. You can.
A little bit. You know, like... Mark,
maybe not. You're 40%
60% of our audience is non-Jewish, but the highly visible portion of the audience is Jewish, right? Right?
Like
for the show. And you know, I worry sometimes. I go, oh God, is anyone going to be? Of course, people are interested in it. They're, you know, in the sense that they're comedy fans. People who love comedy like the show a lot. And it's, but I do worry sometimes. Oh my God, is this going to be too Jewish for someone? Is someone who reads an article about it or listens to a podcast about it gonna be like, well, that sounds funny, but it sounds like it's for Jews, you know?
Yeah.
Like
well, then you'd name the show Just For Us, right? Is that what it is?
Well, the show is called Just For Us for that kind of reason.
No, I know that, but it turns out in the show that, you know, that's not really about Jews.
No, it's something.
But, you know, if you're just reading the listings, you know, the Alex Edelman Jewish comic does Just For Us. I'm like, well, all right, I'm not going to go.
Well, the show, no, it's supposed to be a vague title. It's supposed to be vague. I always believed the titles should be the vague, you know, a little bit vaguer. It should be more thematic.
No, I get it, but it could be misinterpreted as like, is it for Jews?
Yeah, but everyone's the us, right? Like the us in that is Jews and white people and, of course.
From where you're sitting, but on paper.
Shit, I should have called it, it's for Alex Edelman, for everybody, !!
Exactly.
Yeah,
there is no us. But, all right, so when do you start doing comedy in college?
Start doing comedy in high school. I went to rabbinical school. I started doing open mics in Boston. I was terrible.
When you were in high school? That wasn't a Jewish high school, was it?
It was a Jewish high school.
So the yeshiva went all the way from like second grade to high school?
it was no one from kindergarten through graduation. It was like fully a yeshiva high school called Maimonides. But I'd rollerblade down to this music open mic at a pizza place called Rogies in Cleveland Circle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd get up there and I'd do the connection with Kevin Knox and stuff like that. But
Kevin
I was,
Knox, Knoxy. Yeah.
I mean, it was great. And then I got to Israel, and someone had opened up a comedy club in
Jerusalem. What do you mean you got to Israel?
I went to rabbinical school for a year, like a lot of Orthodox Jews do. After high school.
What was that like?
Crazy. Like the craziest place. You're learning to be an adult because there's such arrested development. You're not even close to being one, but I did all this. I'm like, everyone's drinking for the first time. Everyone's, you know, sort of independent, away from home for the first time.
So you were that insulated? You know, I mean,
pretty insulated, yeah.
But you knew enough that you wanted to do comedy in high school, but like your parents, I mean, was there like arranged marriages and whatnot?
No, but yeah. My parents, but like most people married someone who went to the same five schools that
right.
they went to.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
not arranged at all, but like.
But you were vaccinated and whatnot?
Oh, of course, but yeah. You know, it's one of those things where like, I said to my parents a couple years ago, I go, can I get my vaccination records for like, you know, like, and they were like, oh, yeah, I was like, well, was I vaccinated? Did I get, like, the Gardasil vaccine? Did I get all of this?
Yeah,
and my parents, like, call the doctor. And, like, it was one of those, no one ever gave me a sex talk. How's that?
Yeah.
Well, I had,
yeah.
like, a health class in high school, but it was, like, two sessions, and the teacher, everyone laughed at it.
Yeah.
Like, one kid, during a sex ed class, very confidently leaned back and went, when are we going to need this? You know, like it was just a really, like it was calc.
Like algebra, yeah.
But Israel was crazy. And it was also a bad year for violence that year. And there was a massacre at one of the schools near me, called a place called Merkaz Harav. And so it was pretty dicey. And so then I got to college and started lingering around the Comedy Cellar. I was obsessed with it, but I didn't really take it seriously until I went to England.
Well, I mean, so you said there was a comedy club in Israel?
Yeah, a place called Off the Wall. I'm sure, joke I'm sure you get. But it was Off the Wall Comedy Club, and it opened like 2 months after I got there. It was like perfectly timed. And I was like 18 and immediately like one of the five or six comedians in the city. And even though it was horrific.
Yeah.
It was still like enough to get me on stage.
Wait, what, you got like 10, 15 minutes?
Yeah, you get 10, 15 minutes. One time they let me do 40, which was all of my material, you know, from the scraps in the back of your notebooks to whatever. Sure. But yeah, I didn't take it seriously till after college. Then I really kind of got
into it. What is the idea of going to rabbinical school for a year to give you the opportunity to decide whether or not you want to make Judaism your life as a profession?
Just to be able to go, hey, listen, this is the last time you're going to be able to study this, like Torah and Talmud for the sake of just doing that. So you should just do that. Take this time to just go. There are no grades. It's just like a growth experience.
Did you do the studying?
Yeah, I felt kind of out of love with it there in the sense that there wasn't enough original thought for me. Like, I was like, well, what if I had some good teachers, but I also had some ones that were just like, just shut up and learn.
Yeah.
Instead of like wanting to always talk about like trying to relate this to the modern world or trying to figure out a new angle on something. I was obsessed with ideas.
Did you feel at home in Israel?
Yeah, I really did. I feel really weird about saying that. But yeah, I feel at home. It's the first place I'd ever been where everyone's... Like, when I was in Boston, I sort of fell into non-Jewish environments in terms of, like, exploring places like comedy, sports.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or you go to a reading at the Kennedy Library or something you're interested in, like a history thing. Like, you go see, like...
And your dad taught at Harvard?
My dad teaches at Harvard Medical School and MIT.
Yeah.
And so you go to these places, you wear a yarmulke and you're standing out. And people look at you and they shake your hand and their eyes sort of like flick to your head and then come back.
Yeah.
And that never happens in Israel.
Yeah.
So you walk around and everyone's like, and there are a lot of, there's like a lot of brown people wearing yarmulkes, not just the same sort of Ashkenazi folks that you're used to seeing. So it did feel at home in Israel. And also people are arguing all the arguments that we have here about Israel and Judaism and whether or not it should exist or what that should look like. They have those there 10 times. So like, it just feels very familiar.
Yeah.
So I did feel at home in Israel. I really, I felt at home in Jerusalem. And now when I go to Jerusalem, I feel a bit less I guess I have become a little less religious because now I feel really at home in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Where it's like a lot more secular and a lot you know, people much more, less attached to certain stuff. But yeah, I liked going to Israel.
So, all right. So you come back and then you start in, you're hanging around. Because I met you at the Cellar and I remember I had an adverse reaction to you.
I 1,000%. Believe that and don't blame you. I was just like overly keen. I was like,
well, what you were was that, you know, you were dropping a lot of names of a lot of guys because I came up in Boston and we were hanging out and, you know, you're just sort of like telling these stories. I'm like, you can't have those stories. You're a fucking kid. How do you know that, you know?
But so you're not. I was desperate to like fit in and be a comedian. I wasn't
well, where does that take you, that desperation?
What
yeah,
do you
because
mean?
Well, I mean, like, because we, you and I, had a moment recently in the dressing room where I was talking about Frank Santarelli about a story he tells, and then you said, "Oh yeah, I was there," and I'm like, "There's no way you could be there," and you're like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I confused that." Like, there was a moment where I think your need, your desperation to be seen as part of the crew, you know, kind of gets.
I don't think
you.
I was, but the funny thing is, I remember Frank Santarelli doing that. I'm not like doubling down here on it. If you say that like that it didn't happen, I believe you are confused in name, but like, I actually think.
Well, like, I think some people, like, you know, they hear stories because I knew him. Like, I worked with him on Comedy Central in 1990. What year did we do that show? 92, 91, you know, and so that was already a story.
But it's the thing is, I think it's possible that, like, that Santarelli had been like, this thing just happened to me outside or some shit like that.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
but in terms of the desperation, like, I mean, the desperation was to like fit in and become a professional, well, to become a professional comedian. Yeah. Cause like, I did feel like when I started doing comedy, I went, oh, these are my people.
Yeah.
They're so diverse and weird. And also you get to be in the same room with your, imagine you're a musician and you fucking, you're influenced by these like guys who are singer songwriters and then you're playing on the same bill as them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or they were coming in to work out shit. Like Bill Burr would drop into the fucking open mics at the Comedy Vault.
Sure.
Patrice would drop into the, I only saw him once, met him once, but like I said to him, I can't believe you're here. And he was like, this is what, work it out.
Yeah.
Because I can't believe you're at the fucking vault.
Yeah, the vault.
But
Big
it was.
Darity.
Oh, God. But I mean, like, it never paid me.
Mark, you're insecure. That's your problem.
That white ponytail pulled back.
Dude, I used to drive it. He used to open with that preacher bit. I used to open for
him. But I loved that. And it was diverse.
No, it's great.
And it
no.
was, but you're, but by the way, you're right. When you say, where does that desperation take you? On one hand, it's good because whenever you're developing material, you feel everybody behind you going like,
yeah, right.
Okay, you want to sit at the table? Make sure the jokes are, make sure the jokes are not jokes we would ding you for.
Right.
And so that's a decent, and you don't want to be a
motivator.
Tragic case. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, it is good to sort of like, to stop competing so much or to compete in like a different thing or to not feel the insecurity of it. But it took a long time and it took me going to another place to remove myself from that.
So you did all the, you know, you paid your dues a bit in Boston, then you were in New York for a little while, or you didn't really live in New York for comedy though, did you?
No, I was in college, but I did copywriting jobs. I did little ads, wrote ads and like documentaries and things like that, like for an advertising agency. But like, I did my last semester of college in London, and I fell in at this place called the Soho Theater, where you've been.
Yeah, I worked there a couple times.
And they developed these solo shows.
Sure.
And so I was
on the set of other shows.
Yeah. I was obsessed. It was the same thing. I was like, oh my God, this group of people, Phoebe Waller-Bridge was hanging around. She was doing Fleabag. It was like, I felt really, and I met a guy who was my director, who was like my closest friend, this guy, Adam Brace. And we worked together for 11 years. And Adam I met like my last couple of weeks in college. And he was like, you should come back. You should do this, this, and this. And like,
for the one person show thing.
To do Edinburgh. So I went to Edinburgh twice to figure out how to
but not with this show necessarily?
No, I've done three solo shows. So my first show was called Millennial. And I went in 2012 and 2013 as like to do like little bits and stand up stuff and like try to make some extra money. And then in 2014, I went with my first solo show. And that's sort of when I caught a bit of a break. So
which show was that?
It's called Millennial.
Oh, okay.
It was But yeah, it won an award there, and because of that, I was able to keep going back for a little bit.
Right. And what was the second show?
Second show was a show called Everything Handed to You.
Yeah.
And that was 2015. I did it in the same place, and it did better, like, critically and commercially, but it didn't have the sort of like frisson of discovery that the first show had. So
right.
It kind of felt like a letdown, honestly.
So when you're working on your third show, now let's talk about the actual event of going to this white supremacist meeting.
Sure.
So it happens like you say in the show?
But I changed a bunch of like details and names for like sometimes for real life reasons, but mostly for narrative stuff. Like I don't want to ruin anything in the show if possible, like I changed it because Adam was actually pretty instrumental.
Your director?
Yeah, he said to me once, I was fighting for something to go in the show because my instinct was not, my instinct was always let's get as many jokes in there as possible. And his instinct was like, fucking focus, you're telling a story.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's true. And he went, well, it's not funny.
Yeah.
And so like, those are the reasons like things change. But yeah, it's pretty, I'd say sometimes it's like, someone's like, how true is the story? And I'm like, 70%?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Right. But like, yeah, I mean, I imagine some of this stuff, you know, about the characters in the meeting was probably a little forgiving.
A little, sometimes more forgiving, sometimes less. Like, it's composited. It's composited from a whole bunch of things. But, I mean, like, the actual meeting, I didn't know it was going to be stand-up. Like, I told, you know, Danny Jollis?
No.
He's a young comic. I told him the story. I told my friend Morgan.
But you just went because you were like, fuck it?
I had been staffed on a sitcom that I thought was going to run for a while, and then it got canceled.
What was that?
It was a sitcom, The Great Indoors on CBS.
Yeah.
And when it got canceled, I kind of had a bit of like a wilderness thing for like 6 months to a year where I would just like go to shit, and I just like hope that something interesting would like light me up enough to write.
Yeah.
And like, or light me up enough to like not feel like useless. Cause I felt really bad when the show ended and I felt really bad when the show was canceled and I was headlining, but not enough. And so like my friend David Burstein, he was like, we'd go to things together. Like we went to a conference on like nuclear Iran. Cause he was like, it'll be interesting. And so like, I was just like in a space where I was doing a bunch of shit. But I called my mom after this meeting and she went, sweetie, why can't you get a job?
Yeah.
Like, why can't you get another writing job? Because they were so thrilled that I had healthcare.
Yeah.
They were just like, my mom is like, you're doing all, and my mother rarely curses, but she's like, you're doing all this stupid shit. Why not just go get a job?
But never was there a point where she thought like, you know, why would you put yourself in an unsafe situation?
You know, my parents are my parents started letting me leave the house to go to open mics and go to Fenway Park and go to, from the time I was 12 years old, I was always on rollerblades, just like in the T, just trying to like get to places. And I think my parents sort of gave up really quickly and they just sort of trusted. They're like, all right, he's out in the world. Hopefully nothing bad happens.
But you didn't feel like, you know, the way you characterize the white supremacist meeting at this apartment is, you know, like I would think, you know, it was Queens, and I get it, and it's a little odd that's an apartment. But what about the nature of fear?
I was a little churny, but like, you know, I've been in lots of those. I want to say I've been in lots of those situations, but especially in Boston, there were moments where you're at a house party and it doesn't seem safe. Or like, I went to go see Farrakhan speak a few weeks ago.
Yeah,
in Detroit. And if you're listening, you don't know Farrakhan runs the Nation of Islam, and they.
I didn't know he was still alive.
He's 90 years old. And he's a rabid anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Like he is truly, like it was 3.5 hours. He spoke for like 3.5 hours, which is actually pretty impressive, of unmitigated anti-Semitism. And I was like, maybe there were 4 white people in this crowd of like 8,000 people. And whenever he said something anti-Semitic, like the people next to me were like, And I thought to myself, like, should I feel scared right now? Like, is there something wrong where I'm not like, I'm not like, my friend John says that I'm the weirdest mixture of fearful and fearless.
Yeah.
Like, I'm afraid of doing, like, drugs stronger than weed.
Yeah.
Like, I'm, like, terrified of it. And I'm afraid of, like, I'm afraid of a lot, but, like, I've always felt like I kind of can talk my way out of anywhere.
Yeah.
So I've never, I don't really feel afraid in most environments. I'm, like, pretty
adapt and figure out a way out.
There's Mark, like, truly most places have that thing. Like, don't you think if someone dropped you genuinely in the middle of a KKK meeting, eventually you'd be like, hey, listen, you know, like, I'm sorry. If it ever gets truly hairy, you can always be like, excuse me, I'm sorry to be in your space. I'm going to go because this feels.
Well, you hope. I mean, like, from your experience, sure, that's true.
Also, there's, as I say in the show, there's privilege in that, right? Like, there's, I hate when people use privilege to excuse something that can be excused in another way because it feels like lazy and self-congratulating. But truly, walking into that room as a white guy is a thing that only a white guy can do, right? Like a black guy can't.
Right, you knew you could, you know, at least roll the dice.
Yeah, and also, by the way, if I felt truly, 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 truly scared, then I wouldn't have been like, you know, I wouldn't have copped to being Jewish. I thought at some point, well, I've done enough to let them know. That,
right. You wouldn't have been. Good. Also, you wouldn't have been speaking. But it was like from the sound of it, it was a fairly intimate gathering. So you were going to be seen.
Yeah. But no one's going to look at me. I actually do think, by the way, like, obviously, if someone's there are sometimes people have actually said to me, you don't look, you know, you're Jewish. I wasn't quite, you know, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not wearing. That's the thing about not wearing a yarmulke. Like, I actually would love to wear a yarmulke, but I also like to just sort of be in a space and see what's going on.
Well, I think that ultimately what happens, you know, in through the arc of the show, you know, and then the ultimate punchline, which I don't know, even if you made it up, is fine. Mm-hmm. The last beat, but the fact becomes, you know, as a person, mm-hmm. that you know. When you're in a situation where somebody says, you know, this isn't for you.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's an interesting thing because that's not, we're going to kill you. That's not, we're going to beat you up. You know, like, I remember I went to see a lecture at a women's space mm-hmm. in Cambridge because a woman had written this book that I was fascinated with. Mm-hmm. But it was being put on by, I think, an organization called the Women's Space.
Sure.
And I was the only guy in there. And I really just wanted to hear about, you know, it was tracking misogyny through images, you know, from the beginning of images. So mm-hmm. it was sort of an art, you know, whatever. But I just wanted to hear her talk about and speak to it about how you know, you could read it that way. And a woman came up to me and said, you know, this isn't your place.
Yeah.
Obviously you're free to stay, but it's not for you. You're not wanted here. But that's a little different.
No, I mean, it is, but also it's the same, like, sometimes, not to get into a completely different philosophical discussion, but, like, should some spaces be some people only, right? Should there be women's only spaces? Should there be gay only spaces? Does doing that mean that it's harder for people to, you know, access perspective for other people? Well, it's a really interesting question.
But I think rarely is it, there's not a line drawn, it's just understood.
Yeah, of course.
It's, you know, it's based on, you know, fundamental respect. You know, that, like, I get that. And that's who, you know what I mean? It's not like you're not allowed.
But is it wrong? Like, here's a good question, though. Is it wrong of me? Is it okay because Farrakhan is so anti-Semitic and so hateful and so homophobic? Is it okay for me to go to Savior's Day, which is a holy day for people in the Nation of Islam? Is it wrong for me to, as a person, buy a ticket,
walk into the... Is it open to the public?
Yeah, you buy a ticket to go to Huntington Point in Detroit. I flew to Detroit to just see this thing.
No, I mean, it's not wrong. And ultimately, you know, I have found, and maybe you found this too, even if, like, not unlike the Nazi meeting or the white supremacist meeting, is that once you're found out, usually they understand why you're there.
Yeah, of course.
And it's not as an infiltrator. It's, you know, it's a reasonable thing to sort of want to know what's up.
That's exactly how I feel. I've always wanted to. But when I say Boston is a great place to grow up for that, Boston is a great place to go if you want to know what's up.
Absolutely. Like, I used to do those fucking gigs. I was terrified. I was terrified of the Boston Irish for years. You know, I just, because I felt so different. But then I was forcing myself into these situations and doing this comedy for these people. And you do learn what's up. And then if you start doing gigs in Fall River, you understand this sort of Portuguese townie and the Italian townie and the Irish townie. You know, and then you start it. You it's an education and it's an experiment in acceptance and tolerance.
But there is a thing too where I'm like, I love to go to a foreign environment, but it's like England was a good example. I was there for years, but it's not like I didn't always. But even there, I didn't like quite fit in. Even there, it was like it was a thing where people were like, "Who's this fucking guy?" He was just like manages to always like.
Right.
You know, because right. Norwegian used to, you could get a flight, a round trip flight to and from England for like $280 for a while, which was crazy. You'd have to go to Gatwick, but it was, and navigating there was a whole thing. But for a while, it was flying back and forth from England, like, you know, once a month.
Yeah.
And people were like, who's this fucking guy? Who's like, who's here? Who's, you know, who's in Edinburgh? Who's like trying to, you know.
Yeah, but they knew. I mean, it wasn't like it couldn't have been that off-putting.
Yeah, but it was. I'm still a little like, and also the Soho theaters.
But that's
theaters,
an American thing.
Yeah, it's an American thing. But also, like, you know, I was, I learned how to be a comedian in England, and Adam helped me hugely in watching other great comics like James Acaster and, you know, Nish Kumar and Stuart Lee. Like, that really, that shit really helped. It was really, really
good. Yeah, Stuart's great. And James is great, too. I talked to James. So what's the big plan now? I mean, the show is good. It's coming out on HBO. And then, like, what do you ultimately want out of this business with your drive?
I don't know. I think I need a minute.
Well, I mean, do you want to do another show? You want to write a show? You want to be a sitcom called Jew?
I'd love to do another show. I'd love to do a sitcom. Yeah, Jew would be great. Me and Andy Kindler, right?
Yeah. It's just, he plays your dad?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think I need, you know, Adam, I was writing another show with Adam, but Adam passed away. So I think that's,
which was, sorry.
No, it was, not to get too mawkish here, but I really appreciated your last special when I watched it because, you know, Adam was my best friend. So, we did everything together.
What'd he die of?
He had a stroke.
Oh my God.
He was 42 or 43.
Jesus Christ.
But he was, and we made this show together. So I'm putting it to bed and putting it out feels really like,
in honor of him.
Well, yeah. I mean, the special's dedicated to him, obviously, but you know, like it's, I don't know exactly what to do next. Like, I'd like to act just because it seems like fun.
Yeah.
Like, truly, it seems like fun. Like, it feels like a really interesting thing I've never gotten to explore. Like, I've always done a lot of writing.
Yeah.
I've wrote on TV shows. I'm writing some TV shows and some, I'm adapting the Christmas story from the show into a movie. But I don't, you know, I'd love to do another show, but I think I need a fucking minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've never... Adam, I did all three of my solo shows with him directing it, so now I'm not quite sure. I feel like a little bit at a crossroads.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I hear you. But, you know, you're just doing the stand-up, and then it'll just unfold in its own time.
I really hope so. It's just, like, I feel kind of empty in terms of, like, I need a fucking minute, but also, like, you know, I think I'll do some people have asked about acting, some people have asked, and, like, writing. So, like, I love doing other stuff, but I think I need a minute away from solo shows to like go empty other things. But there's nothing like a solo show, man. There's nothing like a substantive hour of stand up.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's satisfying. The acting, I hope you get a lot out of it. I mean, it's a lot of waiting around.
Yeah, but you do it. You had a blast in the
Glow or my show or whatever.
Yeah, your show.
When you're on camera, yeah, you have a blast. But then, you know, and I got to stop complaining about this. I'm never going to get work. But you know, the waiting around thing. Yeah, figure out what to do in the trailer. Plan it now.
Do some writing, do some reading.
Good luck with that.
But I fucking love, I mean, like, I did a little tiny bit in this Seinfeld movie that's coming out. Like, and I mean tiny. Like, it's basically a cameo.
Yeah.
But it was so fun to be on a set with the cameras. Like, it's a whole new.
Yeah.
I want a new environment, man. That's all I want. For the time being. But I'll go back to stand-up doing all this stuff.
And seems like it's going to happen for you.
I don't know. I have no idea. Genuinely. Like, I'm not
being false anything. No one does, buddy. Anything. No one does. People go up, people go down, but you're on the peak of a wave. Enjoy yourself, Jew.
I hope so. Thanks, bud.
All right, man. Well, there you go. So you can watch Just For Us, Alex's special, streaming on Max and airing on HBO. Hang out for a minute, people.
Hold up.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Yes, people! For full Marin listeners, we've got a companion piece for this week's Carol Burnett episode. It's an archive deep dive about all the comedy legends we've had on the show, like Jonathan Winters, Carl Reiner, and Mel Brooks.
That was great. It was great because these guys don't know, you know, they all still have AOL addresses. They don't know what I'm doing. You know, they know I'm coming over there with a microphone. And, you know, when I show up by myself, they're always sort of like, just you, you know, like, you know, but I went over to Mel's office. Yeah. And his assistant was there and she just, you know, led me into the room and he was, you know, getting a cracker or something. I remember. So you're like, you want one of these? You know, I'm all right. You know, and it just was right away. He was like locked in.
I think at some point he had a sandwich.
Yeah, I think that's right. You want it? Because I remember he was like one of those guys. You want a sandwich?
Yeah.
Anything? Yeah. And that was a very interesting interview because there was all these little pockets of his life that were kind of fascinating. You know, the childhood friendship with Buddy Rich.
Yeah.
You know, in
he loved
in
that you knew that stuff. He was so excited that when you would bring up these like big band people to him and he'd be like, Artie, you know, Shaw. That? Oh yeah. And he would launch into, you know, his stories of drumming.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are like, that's a real entry point. If you can find those things and you're intuitive about it or you have instincts about it, it's a great place to start with almost anybody. To get that episode and all the full Marin bonus episodes, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus to sign up. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a deep cut Lou Reed riff. Monkey and Levana got angels everywhere.